The three practices of the debate maker. Number one, frame the issue. Define the question. Form the team. Assemble the data. Frame the decision. Number two, spark the debate. Create safety for best thinking. Demand rigor. Number three, drive a sound decision. Re-clarify the decision-making process. Make the decision. Communicate the decision and rationale. Becoming a debate maker. Make a debate with four asks. Number one, ask the hard question. Number two, ask for evidence. Number three, ask everyone. Number four, ask people to switch. Leveraging resources. Decision makers. What they do. Engage a select inner circle in the decision-making process. What do they get? They get underutilization of the bulk of their resources, while a select few are overworked. They get a lack of information from those closest to the action, resulting in poorer decisions. They get too many resources thrown at those who don't have the understanding they need to execute the decisions effectively. Debate makers. What do? They access a wide spectrum of thinking in a rigorous debate before making decisions. What do they get? They get high utilization of the bulk of their resources. They get real information they need to make sound decisions. They get efficient execution with lower resource levels because they've built a deep understanding of the issues, which readies the organization to execute. Unexpected findings. Number one, as a leader, you can have a very strong opinion, but also facilitate debate that creates room for other people's views. Data is the key. Number two, debate makers are equally comfortable being the decision maker in the end. They are not only consensus-driven leaders. Number three, rigorous debate doesn't break down a team. It builds the team and makes it stronger. Chapter 6. The Investor. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. It is after midnight at the McKinsey office in Seoul, South Korea. The lights are out, except in one conference room occupied by a project team that is 2 days away from a critical presentation to one of the firm's biggest clients in Asia. The team is led by Hyunji, a sharp, highly regarded project leader. Joining them this night is Jay Choi, one of McKinsey's partners based in Seoul. Jay knows the team has a critical deadline and, as is typical, is meeting with the team to guide, challenge, and shape the thinking as they build the first major presentation of their findings to the client. The project leader, Hyungji, is at the whiteboard. She and the team are retesting the storyline with some new facts that surfaced during the past week. The team is struggling to integrate the findings into the overarching message about the client's business transformation. Jay listens carefully and asks a lot of questions, as he is known for doing. It becomes clear that the team is stuck. The team leader is systematically working this tough problem, but looks at Jay with a look that signals, "I could use a little help here." Jay has been on countless numbers of these projects and has stood in the project leader's shoes many times. He can see a storyline that the team, who has been buried in the details, has not yet considered. Jay offers a few thoughts for the team to discuss, standing up to take the whiteboard marker from the team leader. Heading to the board, he begins to list several emerging themes, encouraging the team to view the facts from a different angle. The group is thrilled to have the fresh perspective, and excited voices are now engaged in testing, pushing, and building on the ideas despite the late hour. With new insights coming from the renewed discussions, Jay can now visualize the new presentation flow in his mind. He feels a familiar comfort up at the whiteboard. The desire to drive the team toward completion is alluring. He's tempted to lay it all out for the team so they can all go home and get some rest. The consultant in Jay tells him to go on and finish the job and complete the storyline himself. But the leader in Jay signals restraint. He stops sketching and turns to the project leader, checking to see if she is comfortable with the new direction. Seeing the smile on her face, Jay says, "Okay, looks like we've got a new line of thinking to run with. Let's see what you can do with this." He then hands the pen back to Hyun-ji, who resumes command of the process and leads a team to build an outstanding presentation for the client. Surely it was tempting for Jay to jump in, rescue the struggling team, and drive the presentation to completion himself. He would have felt like a hero, and probably a few years younger too. And it was tempting for the team to let him do it, given the late hour. But Jay's proclivity to invest in people and their development won out. Jay reflected on the leader's role. You can jump in and teach and coach, but then you have to give the pen back. When you give that pen back, your people know they are still in charge. When something is off the rails, do you take over or do you invest? When you take the pen to add your ideas, do you give it back or does it stay in your pocket? Multipliers invest in the success of others. They may jump in to teach and share their ideas, but they always return to accountability. When leaders fail to return ownership, they create dependent organizations. This is the way of the diminisher. They jump in, save the day, and deliver results through their personal involvement. When leaders return the pen, they cement accountability for action where it should be. This creates organizations that are free from the nagging need of the leader's rescue. Multipliers enable others to operate independently by giving other people ownership of results and investing in their success. Multipliers can't always be present to perform emergency rescues, so they ensure that people on their teams are self-sufficient and can operate without their direct presence. Thus far, the book has explored why multipliers make people smarter and more capable in their presence. Now, I ask you to consider a different question. What happens when the multiplier isn't there? What happens to people when the sunlight of the multiplier isn't shining in their part of the world? This chapter addresses this most curious question. How do multipliers create organizations that act intelligently and achieve results without their direct involvement? The micromanager versus the investor. Multipliers operate as investors. They invest by infusing others with the resources and ownership they need to produce results independent of the leader. It isn't just benevolence. They invest and they expect results. Forever strong. Larry Gelweck stood on the side of the rugby pitch watching his high school team practice. He thought back to the first team he had coached to the national championships. He remembered them being up before dawn, training together. Larry said under his breath, "Well, that was then." The team in front of him was good, to be sure. They were learning the game, but he noticed they didn't have the physical stamina of previous teams. Larry felt stuck. It wasn't like he hadn't tried. He reminded them at practice all the time. They would nod their heads, but then they didn't do it. He could cancel practices and hold fitness training in its place, but that would put the skill level of the team at risk. He could yell at them, and that would work for only a day or two. Larry leaned over to his assistant coach and said, "We need to turn this over to the captains." The next day, Larry stood up, walked quickly to the chalkboard, and drew a line from one side of the board to the other. He said, "We have 6 weeks left until the finals. And it takes a pretty good athlete 6 or 7 weeks to build the endurance he needs." The coaches and captains were listening to every word. He continued, "If we figure this out now, we can win the nationals. If we can't, we'll be running on empty." He gave them the lowdown. There are two options. The coaches can keep trying to figure something out, or you as the captains can take ownership for finding a solution. What should we do? There was a pause. Then the captain of the back said, "We'll take it on." Larry said, "Right now I own this challenge. Once you take it on, you'll own it completely. We'll expect an update from you 2 weeks from today, but we won't bug the team at all." There was silent agreement in the look that passed between the captains. Then the captain of the forward stood up and went to the board. He turned to Larry, who had sat down with the other coaches, and said, "Okay, we have a few questions." Larry and the coaches stayed and answered questions about what types of fitness training produce speed, agility, and endurance, until eventually the coaches were excused, and the four captains, all in their teens, took a turn figuring it out, standing in a semicircle around the chalkboard. The solution they implemented was to divide the team into small groups of 4 to 6 people, each with its own leader. The captains would keep the subgroup leaders accountable, and the leaders would keep the players accountable. The smaller groups met before or after school for fitness training for weeks, and the team soon became one of the fittest in the 34 years Larry had coached the team. They went undefeated all season and won the national championship. How would a micromanaging coach have approached the same problem? We don't need to wonder. Calling every play. Marcus Dolan shouted across the school at John Kimball, "Get over here." Marcus was a musclehead coach who wanted to micromanage every aspect of his team. He yelled at one of his team captains, "Don't ever hold a practice without me or you'll be off this team. You've probably already messed everyone up." Not surprisingly, John didn't try that again, and little by little, he and the other players slowly stopped taking initiative entirely. Playing for Marcus meant you did what he said without question. The endless laps at practice just had to be done. Even in the games, he called every play for every player. The team was so focused and dependent on Marcus, they couldn't think intelligently or adapt rapidly to changes on the field. They lost every game. Marcus took a group of players that had begun with a sense of ownership for the team and micromanaged it out of them. Interestingly, Sports Illustrated later elected Marcus Dolan as the most losing coach in high school sports history. More interesting still, 8 of his players eventually left the team and went to play for Larry Gelweix. In fact, they were on the team described earlier that woke before dawn to practice, and the same team that led Highland to its first national championship. Running onto the field. Why is it that when the stakes are high, many managers jump in and take over? I've watched hundreds of youth soccer games, and I have to admit that I find myself watching the coaches more than the players. It's one of the curses of genius watching. I've seen a lot of very frustrated coaches during those games when the team is down and playing horribly. I've seen crazy arm waving, copious shouting, occasional tantrums on the sidelines. But I've never once seen a coach run out onto the field, steal the ball away from a player, drive down the field, and score. Yet, each one of these coaches had the skills required to score the game-winning goal. And I'm sure a few have been tempted to do it. But why don't they? Beyond the obvious reason that it is against the rules, it simply isn't their role. Their job is to coach, and their player's job is to play. What perhaps isn't so obvious is why, when the stakes are high, many managers in the organization don't hesitate to run onto the playing field, steal away the ball, and score the winning goal. Managers jump in because in their organization it isn't illegal, and many can't resist the temptation. Consider 2 such examples that occur every day in our workplaces. First, the sales manager who doesn't see fast enough progress in winning an important prospective client and jumps into the sales process trying to win the deal himself. Second, the marketing vice president who watches one of her people stumble as he presents the new product go-to-market plan to the CEO. When the CEO fires tough questions at him, the marketing VP leaps in and not only answers the tough questions, but finishes the presentation. You might ask yourself, how would I coach if I could never step out onto the playing field? How would I lead if I couldn't jump in and take over? How would I respond to a performance gap if I were a multiplier? Multipliers understand that their role is to invest, to teach, and to coach, and they keep the accountability for the play with the players. By doing so, they create organizations that can win without them on the field. Let's now explore the discipline of the investor and how multipliers create organizations that can perform and win, not only without them on the field, but long after their direct influence has ended. The investor. Ilabat, known as Ilaben, is a slight 78-year-old Indian woman, soft-spoken to the point of seeming at first a bit fragile. She lives in the simplest two-bedroom bungalow, with her bed doubling as a desk chair. She grew up listening to her teachers speak of India's struggle for independence, and her parents tell stories of her grandfather, who joined the 24-day salt march from Mohandas K. Gandhi's ashram in Ahmedabad to the Arabian Sea to make salt, in symbolic defiance of British law. In order to gain first-hand experience of rural poverty, Ilaben went to live in the villages of India and saw for herself that the political independence gained from British rule was not enough. Economic independence would be the next victory. In the villages, she saw both the vibrancy and the struggle of the self-employed seamstresses, street vendors, and construction workers, and in response, founded the Self-Employed Women's Association, SEWA, in 1972, which gradually became a significant union in the region. It would have been easy for Ilaben to be elected General Secretary of SEWA every 3 years as dictated by law, forever. In this way, she could have owned the organization's agenda indefinitely and just assigned tasks to everyone else. SEWA, after all, was her creation. It had evolved slowly in her mind, and it would have been understandable, if not expected, for her to remain its formal leader in perpetuity. Yet Ilaben insisted on turning over the responsibility of running SEWA to new and younger leadership. She personally invested the time and energy into educating members about the democratic process and encouraged everyone to gain the political literacy needed to step up and run for one of the open positions. In a fascinating embodiment of SEWA's mission and management philosophy, Jyoti Makwan, who enrolled as a member of SEWA as a poor, Gujarati-speaking, cigarette-rolling worker, went on to become the English-speaking General Secretary for SEWA. In this role, she has led the union, which at the most recent election involved 1.2 million people. Jyoti could have spent her work years figuring out how to survive from day to day, but because of Ilaben's leadership, she has used her intellect solving complex problems that reach across international boundaries and affect more than 1 million women like herself. She recently stood shoulder to shoulder with Ilaben and then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as they answered questions at a press conference. Jyoti's story is just the beginning. If you look at the second generation of chief executives of all the SEWA organizations, they all first worked under Ilaben's tutelage. Each was given greater and greater ownership as they matured into capable managers. Every time Ilaben established an institution, she invested in the future leaders and stepped away from the operational management. Each time, the succession was handled so gracefully that she could leave with the confidence that her presence would still be felt even when she is elsewhere, investing her energy in establishing another institution. The SEWA Union was followed by a bank, created from 4,000 women each depositing 10 rupees. And this has been followed by the Gujarat Mahila Housing SEWA Trust, the Gujarat State Mahila SEWA Cooperative Federation, SEWA Insurance, SEWA Academy, HomeNet South Asia, and many others. Iliben continues to invest in building leaders and organizations so they can operate independently of her. Her influence is like that of a parental figure or wise elder who gives guidance when people ask for it, support when she is needed. Her approach to management is the outgrowth of her simple motto, a leader is someone who helps others lead. Today, Iliben serves as a member of the Elders, an international non-governmental organization of public figures noted as elder statesmen, peace activists, and human rights advocates who were brought together by Nelson Mandela in 2007. How does a leader like Iliben create other leaders who can assume ownership and deliver on the mission of the organization themselves? We find answers in the three practices of the investor. The three practices of the investor. As we studied the unique way multipliers drive results, I found the practices remarkably similar to another world I know. A world driven by intellectual assets and investment multiples, where technology and business leaders develop other leaders in search of growth and returns and the creation of wealth. This is a world whose nerve center is just a mile from my house. On Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, California, home to Silicon Valley's venture capital community, multi-million-dollar investment decisions are made many times daily. Venture capital firms scour industries looking to invest in emerging technologies and young companies destined to become industry leaders of the future. When a venture firm places its bet and invests a round of funding, it draws up a term sheet to govern the deal. Of particular interest to all parties is the specification of ownership levels. These ownership levels outline relative ownership for the business post-investment and dictate expectations for leadership and for accountability. Simply put, the term sheet lets the parties know who's in charge. Once ownership of the new company is established, the venture firm cuts a check and the investment of resources begins. The funding provides the financial resources to secure capital, intellectual property, and the human resources to fuel the business. But the value isn't limited to the financial resources. The real value often emerges from the insight and coaching the startup company receives from the senior partners at the venture firm. Men and women who have grown businesses, incubated technology, and often managed very large companies themselves. They not only invest the capital of the fund, they invest their know-how into these nascent companies. They coach the CEO. They lend their Rolodex to assist with business development and sales. And they work with the management team to ensure financial targets can be met. After infusing capital and know-how, the venture partners look for expected returns. The returns in the marketplace may be years away, or may never materialize, but they watch for key milestones. The accountability is clear. If the company produces expected results, a second or third round of funding is likely. Otherwise, the company is left to make it on its own or die on the vine. Similarly, in their role as investors, multipliers define ownership up front and let other people know what is within their charge and what they are expected to build. They invest in the genius of others in a similar way. They teach and coach. They back people up, infusing the resources they need to be successful and to be independent. And multipliers complete the same investment cycle as they demand accountability from others. They understand that this accountability isn't ruthless. It is the draw that creates such extraordinary growth of intelligence and capability in others. We'll look at each of these three steps in turn. 1, defining ownership. 2, investing resources. And 3, holding people accountable. Practice number 1, defining ownership. Investors begin this cycle by establishing ownership up front. They see intelligence and capability in the people around them, and they put them in charge. Name the lead. When John Chambers, then CEO of Cisco, hired his first vice president, Doug Allred, into the company, he gave the new VP of customer support control and made sure their respective roles were clear. He said, "Doug, when it comes to how we run this area of the company, you get 51% of the vote, and you're 100% responsible for the result. Keep me in the loop and consult with me as you go." Weeks later, when Doug was updating John on progress, John responded with, "I knew you'd surprise me on the upside." And it wasn't just Doug who received majority voting rights. John gives 51% of the vote to every member of his management in their respective areas of accountability. If your boss told you that you owned 51% of the vote, how would you operate? Would you second guess yourself and run all decisions by him? Or would you swing in the opposite direction and make decisions without consulting him? You probably would do neither. Most likely, you would consult your boss on important decisions to get a second opinion, while for the smaller stuff, you might be wise to ignore him or her as needed to get your job done. Giving someone 51% of the vote and full ownership creates certainty and builds confidence. It enables them to stop second guessing and start getting second opinions. Clarifying the role that you will play as a leader actually gives people more ownership, not less. They then understand the nature of your involvement and when and how you will invest in their success. Most important, they understand that they hold the majority ownership position, and the success or failure hinges on their efforts. Give ownership for the end goal. A management team is assembled for an offsite meeting to plan an important acquisition for their business. They kick off their work with a simple but powerful management exercise called the big picture. The team divides into 9 pairs, and each pair is given a 1-inch square from a photo of a famous modern painting. Each team is tasked with creating a reproduction and enlargement of its piece of the picture. In other words, each team is given a little piece of a bigger picture. The goal for the team is to bring all the enlargements together to form a unified replica of the original painting. The result should be a painting that is technically accurate and flows together seamlessly. The challenge is that no pair has seen the big picture. I hope you can visualize the scene. Each pair, energized by the challenge, studies their 1-inch square and begins to replicate it onto the large piece of paper in front of them. They dive into the task, make sketches, and soon color erupts everywhere. When the time allotted for the first phase of work expires, they turn their attention to neighboring colleagues. They begin to connect the pieces and notice that the painting isn't coming together very well. The lines don't match up. The colors don't blend. Their creation is like a Franken painting. The session leader reminds them that their job is to optimize the whole, not their individual piece. They start to pay attention to the bigger picture. They rework their sections, focusing on integration and blending, though it is far too late to create a seamless product. The team delivers the big picture, but it remains a patchwork, only moderately resembling the original artwork. When people are given ownership for only a piece of something larger, they tend to optimize that portion, limiting their thinking to this immediate domain. When people are given ownership for the whole, they stretch their thinking and challenge themselves to go beyond their scope. Stretch the role. We consistently find that multipliers get twice the capability from their people that diminishers do. And time after time, people tell us that multipliers not only got 100% of their skills and know-how, but 120% or even more. Multipliers do get more than 100% because people grow under the watch of a multiplier. One way that multipliers incite this growth is by asking people to stretch and do something they've never done before. Consider these 3 individuals. Eleanor Schaffner Moss was a champion who needed a bigger cause. As the marketing director for the small IT, information technology, practice within Booz Allen Hamilton in 1988, she ran basic demand generation programs. But she suddenly found herself with a really big job when Booz Allen Hamilton decided to turn over the reins of the IT practice to a different partner who was intent on transforming the function. Within months, she was organizing a corporate-wide kickoff event to launch the vision for the IT practice. Next, she convened a forum of the top CIOs in the world. When she found herself sitting next to the CEO of Booz Allen Hamilton during one of the meetings, she confidently explained to him why the IT industry and the IT practice inside their firm was going to change the world. She later said, "I wasn't afraid of anything or anyone. We knew what we were doing, and we felt like we could do anything." Mike Hagan was ready to take on the world, but he literally needed a passport. He worked as the director of sales operations for the billion-dollar U.S. sales division of a multinational company. His job was to make sure the sales force complied with company policy. When the president of the sales division wanted to globalize and grow the business, he tapped Mike to figure this out. One day, Mike was the policy police, writing tickets for sales administration offenders. The next day, he was the architect of sales operations and policy for the entire global business. Initially, Mike protested, citing his inexperience with global operations, and he confessed that he didn't even have a current passport. His protests were ignored. The president told him that he was smart and he would surely figure this out. And he did. The experience was grueling, but invigorating. Mike reflected, "I was given an opportunity to do something I had never done before. In fact, no one had ever done it." The job was huge, but Mike grew into it as predicted. Polly Sumner was a powerhouse waiting to be unleashed. When a new president joined Oracle, he noticed this channel sales manager's strategic savvy and drive and asked her to assume a vice president role, running alliances and strategic partnerships. In time, Polly was right in the middle of a very messy, high-stakes conflict. The management team could not agree on how quickly Oracle would release new versions of its database code to its applications partner and competitor, SAP. Polly escalated the issue to her new boss, who responded, "This is a complex issue and probably beyond the scope of your role, but you should be the one to lead the resolution." Polly went right to the people who could fix the problem. She found herself brokering a conversation between the billionaire founders and CEOs, Hasso Plattner of SAP and Larry Ellison of Oracle, in a meeting held at Larry's favorite Japanese tea house. The issue was resolved to their mutual satisfaction, and Polly was a superstar. These three individuals all worked for the same boss, just in different settings. Who was the common denominator in this equation? It was Ray Lane, known for challenging his team and for extracting every ounce of their capability. When we asked people why they gave Ray so much, their answers revealed a consistent story. He asked them to go outside their comfort zones. He could spot smarts in others, and he gave people a chance to stretch well beyond their current capabilities. He gave them ownership, not at the level of their current capability, but always one and occasionally two levels up. When investors stretch the role, they stretch the person in it. This bigger role creates a vacuum that must be filled. Practice number two, investing resources. The moment investors establish an ownership position, they step in and begin investing. They protect their investment by infusing the knowledge and resources the person will need to successfully deliver on their accountability. Teach and coach. When Jay Choi at McKinsey inserted himself into the discussion with the project team, it wasn't to show and tell what he knows. He grabbed the pen so he could teach and coach. It is a simple and vital distinction. Diminishers tell you what they know. Multipliers help you learn what you need to know. Jay is not only a business leader, but also an avid teacher who looks for the teachable moments when a team is spinning or has suffered a setback. That's when minds are most open and hungry, and he knows how to contribute a relevant insight or ask just the right question to move the group forward. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, who has been described several times earlier, is another masterful teacher. KR's teaching doesn't occur in a classroom or a corporate training center. He has to coach right in the middle of a tough game and in the face of very real problems. When the team is wrestling with a technical setback, KR engages not with a solution, but with a thought-provoking question. He'll ask, "What do we know about what doesn't work?" And, "What assumptions led us to these outcomes? And what risks do we face now that need to be mitigated?" His team pursues these questions in turn, unearthing their individual knowledge and building a collective body of intelligence. KR says, "You are teaching by helping your team solve real problems. Even if you know the solution, you don't offer it. If you do, you've lost the teaching moment. It has to be Socratic. You ask the question and tease out the answer." Although KR focuses on immediate problems, his investment in these teaching moments returns far more than just solutions to these problems. When leaders teach, they invest in their people's ability to solve and avoid problems in the future. This is one of the most powerful ways that multipliers build intelligence around them. Provide backup. When you think of investing intellectual capital in your direct reports, it is easy to assume that you are the one who needs to provide the capital. But this limits the investment options to what you know and what you have time and energy to invest. Additionally, when you are the sole investor, your presence can be overpowering and your attempts to help can be more disruptive than beneficial, especially when the stakes are high. When people are stretched and working above their current capability level, they're bound to trip up or take false steps. These situations are ripe for diminishers, especially well-meaning managers prone to rescuing struggling employees. How can a manager intervene without usurping control? A wise multiplier ensures there's a safety net in place, a planned backup, someone the employee can go to for advice on how to recover gracefully. It should be no surprise that the best safety nets are not managers. Very few people enjoy falling on their backs and getting rescued by their bosses. Typically, the best people to provide this layer of support are colleagues who can offer guidance without undertones of judgment and disappointment. Instead of jumping in, the investor provides a backup. When leaders define clear ownership and invest in others, they have sown the seeds of success and earned the right to hold people accountable. Practice number 3, holding people accountable. In working with hundreds of business executives, there is something I've noticed about the finest of these leaders. They all appear to have slanted tables in their offices. Sure, the desks they sit at with their computer and their phone is perfectly flat, but their meeting table has a distinct slant to it. Perhaps you may not have noticed, but surely you have seen how accountability for action rolls from their side of the table down to other people, and often to you. It may look flat to the unsuspecting eye, but if you placed a marble on one side, that marble would surely roll right off the opposite end. These leaders have a natural leaning to give accountability to others and keep it there. When their people push problems over to the manager's side of the table, by the end of the conversation, those problems slide right back to where they came from. The leader helps, offers suggestions, asks great questions, and may highlight or escalate a critical issue, but the accountability slides back and rests with their staff. Their tables slant in the direction of other people. One senior executive I worked for carried a small leather notebook with him in every meeting. Strangely, he never took meeting notes in it, But in every meeting, he was mentally present and fully engaged, listened intently, and offered carefully dispensed insight. During these meetings, I would furiously take notes, making careful notation of my action items, and others did the same. On rare occasions, I would see him write a single note. These occasions were reserved for when he alone was accountable for an action. This was the slanted desk in action. This leader knew how to keep the accountability with his people. He was fully engaged, but he did not take over. And because he assumed accountability with careful restraint, when he wrote an action down in his little leather book, you could be sure it would get done without delay. Give it back. Investors get involved in other people's work, but they continually give back leadership and accountability. John Wookey is an executive vice president of industry applications at Salesforce, a veteran in the application software business, and a multiplier who builds organizations with know-how. He knows that delivering software on time and with quality isn't a hands-off job, but he sees a clear distinction between micromanaging and being involved in the work people are doing. One of the breeding grounds for micromanagement in the software development business is the user interface review meeting. A typical software application has about 250 screens whose usability can make or break the product in the marketplace. So most executives are keenly interested in getting this right. By the end of a user interface review meeting, the micromanaging development executive will have seized the pen, sprung to the whiteboard, and redesigned the screens himself in front of the group as an impressive show of his design savvy. John has seen his former peers and bosses do this countless times. When John sees problems in the screens, he makes suggestions, discusses options and trade-offs, and then asks the team to go back to their lab and figure it out. John says, "I give people feedback as guidance rather than an order because I assume that someone who's been working on something full-time for many weeks has insight into it that I won't have after a few minutes." John does offer his insights, gained from decades of building business applications, and reminds his team to think about what real users need from the software. He keeps his guidance focused on what they can all do to build a product that they can take pride in. John does jump in, but like the partner at McKinsey in Seoul, he hands the pen back. By doing so, he signals that he's interested and engaged, but not the one in charge. He gives it back, and the accountability for designing and building a great product stays with the other person, who incidentally is also built up in the process. Michael Clark, the president of infrastructure at Flextronix, has a clever little two-step process for giving accountability back to people in a way that encourages their continued intellectual contribution. He listens to a presentation or an idea with interest, and then with a wry smile and a thick Yorkshire accent says, "Hey, that is good thinking." So he begins by praising the edge of great thinking. Then he affirms their ownership of the business problem at hand by saying, "I'd love to know whether we should invest in X or Y. I mean, you're smart. You can figure this out." These words are heard again and again by his team. "You're smart. You figure it out." Their ideas are validated, and the onus for solving the issue is back with them. Expect complete work. It was the summer of 1987, and I had just landed the internship of my dreams. I would be working for Kerry Patterson, a former professor of organizational behavior at the business school that I attended, who was now running a management training company in Southern California. Kerry was known for his brilliant and slightly demented mind. Kerry is what happens when you pack an Einstein-sized brain into a Danny DeVito-sized body. Everyone wanted to work for Kerry, but I managed to get the job through some combination of faculty recommendation and advanced Jedi mind tricks. I eagerly drove to Southern California to work and study under his mentorship. As in most internships, I did an assortment of odd jobs. I created training content and did computer work and even handled a few stray legal issues. But my favorite job was editing anything that Carrie wrote. Sometimes it was a training manual, sometimes it was a speech, but my job was always to edit and find and fix mistakes. On this particular day, I was editing a marketing brochure that Carrie had written. I did the usual routine. I found and fixed typos and grammar errors. I rewrote a few sentences that were awkward. Then I stumbled on a particularly troublesome tangle of words. I tried a couple times to rewrite the sentences, but I couldn't think of anything better than what Carrie had written, and it was too big a mess for me to fix. I figured Carrie, with his great big brain, would know best what to do. So I labeled it as awkward by noting the standard editorial term, AWK, in the margin. About an hour after I returned the document to Carrie's desk, he returned from a meeting to find my edits. I heard him marching down the hall toward my office, and his pace indicated that he wasn't coming to thank me. He burst across the threshold and marched right up to my desk. Feeling somewhat worried, I sat up straight, getting ready for whatever Carrie was going to throw at me. Without so much as a hello, he dropped the document in front of me with a dramatic thump, looked me straight in the eye, and said, "Don't ever give me an AWK without an FIX." With a twinkle in his eye, the consummate teacher turned and left my office. Point taken. I worked a little harder, applied a little more brain power, and fixed the awkward sentences. I snuck back into Carrie's office and returned the new edit to his desk. Carrie continued to teach and write prolifically and is the author of 4 best-selling books: Crucial Conversations, Crucial Confrontations, Influencer, and Change Anything. I completed the internship, finished business school, and then made my way into the corporate world, having learned from Carrie one of the most important professional lessons: never give someone an AWK without an FIX. Don't just identify the problem, find a solution. Throughout my management career, I've told this story to dozens of people, perhaps hundreds. I've shared it with virtually every person who worked on my team and dropped a problem on my desk without an attached solution. I passed along, "Don't give me an AWK without an FIX." When we ask for the FIX, the fix, we give people an opportunity to complete their thinking and their work. We encourage them to stretch and exercise intellectual muscles that might otherwise atrophy in the presence of other smart, capable people. Multipliers never do anything for their people that their people can do for themselves. Respect natural consequences. Several years ago, our family took a vacation to Maui, Hawaii. We parked ourselves on the beach at the very end of Kaanapali at the base of Black Rock Point. It is a beautiful beach, but at that spot, the ocean confronts the huge rock jutting out of the beach and the surf can be rough. My then 3-year-old, Christian, was fascinated by the ocean and kept straying out of the baby waves and into the dangerous surf. The scene is familiar to every parent. He would venture out too far, then I would go fetch him back, get down at eye level, and tell him about the power of the ocean and why it is too dangerous for him to go out so far. He would resume playing, forget my teaching, and venture out again. We repeated the cycle several times. I decided it was time for him to learn the lesson from Mother Nature instead of from Mom. I watched for a mid-sized wave to come toward shore. I selected one that would give him a good topple, but wouldn't sweep him off to Japan. Instead of pulling him back in as the wave approached, I let him venture out. And rather than grabbing his arm and lifting him out of the water, I simply stood by his side. Several parents nearby looked alarmed as they saw the wave coming. One tried to get my attention by giving me that bad mother look. I assured him that I was on duty, but more as a teacher than a lifeguard. The wave came in and instantly dragged Christian under the surf and tossed him around several times. After he had had a good tumble, I pulled my toddler back up to safety. Once he caught his breath and spit out the sand, we had a talk about the power of the ocean. This time, he seemed to understand and now stayed closer to shore. He continues to love the ocean, is an avid surfer, and displays a respect for the power of nature. Nature teaches best. When we let nature take its course and allow people to experience the natural consequences of their actions, they learn most rapidly and most profoundly. When we protect people from experiencing the natural ramifications of their actions, we stunt their learning. Real intelligence gets developed through experimentation and by trial and error. Allowing consequences to have their effect allows natural forces to inform intelligent action. It communicates that the manager believes people are smart enough to figure things out. People become more independent because they feel they own their actions, as well as the results or consequences of those actions. Investors want their investments to be successful, but they know they can't intervene and alter natural market forces. By providing the possibility to fail, these leaders give others the freedom and the motivation to grow and succeed. Ilevin Bot captured this well when she said, "There are risks in every action. Every success has the seed of some failure." Multipliers have a core belief that people are smart and will figure things out. So it makes sense that they operate as investors, giving ownership that keeps rolling back to other people. They invest the resources they need to grow a business and the people in it. They engage personally, offering their insights and guidance, but they remember to give the pen back when they are done so people remain accountable to deliver on expected returns. Through investing in others, multipliers generate independence in others. They create organizations that can sustain performance without their direct involvement. When the organization is truly autonomous, these leaders have earned the right to step away. When they leave a legacy. The diminisher's approach to execution. The diminisher operates from a very different assumption. People will never be able to figure it out without me. They believe if they don't dive into the details and follow up, other people won't deliver. These assumptions breed dependency among people, as full ownership is never offered to them. Diminishers assign piecemeal tasks, then jump in believing that other people cannot make it work without them. Unfortunately, in the end, these assumptions are often proven true, because people become disabled and dependent on the diminisher for answers, for approval, and to integrate the pieces together. When this happens, diminishers look outward, asking themselves only, "Why are people always letting me down?" When diminishers eventually leave an organization, things fall apart. Things crumble because the leader has held the operation together with micromanagement and sweat equity. Consider the private equity investor in Brazil, who stifled his entire organization with his micromanagement. Celso is extraordinarily smart and considered by his colleagues to be a financial genius. He was a superior analyst and a rock star of a stock trader. But his control freak management style hampered his ability to build great companies. Unfortunately, as the head of a private equity firm, his job was exactly that, to build companies. In staff meetings, his staff rarely got through their reports on prospective investments or portfolio companies before he interrupted with his pithy analysis. Sure, he'd make a few great points, but it discouraged other people from thinking. His signature remark was, "I can't believe you haven't figured this out." Celso tracked performance of their portfolio companies with second-by-second monitoring and arranged to receive all company sales reports on his cell phone. When sales dipped off target, he'd call the CEO at random hours of the night and start screaming. Whatever the situation, Celso was the first to respond. Like Pavlov's dog, there was no delay between stimulus and response. When he found a problem, he'd jump in immediately and try to fix it himself. Over time, Celso's micromanagement created a sharp division inside the organization. Most of his colleagues would lie low, knowing that he eventually would do things himself. As much of the talent retreated, he compensated by hiring aggressive graduates of elite colleges who didn't have enough experience to expect a different type of leadership. The organization began to look a lot like CELSO over time and resembled an alpha male annual convention with a revolving door. Like many diminishers, CELSO's micromanagement stifled the intelligence within an organization chock full of really smart people. Let's look at the ways in which diminishers cripple the capability of their people and create dependent organizations. Maintain ownership. The approach of the micromanager is well captured in a comment made by a staff member of a prominent professor. I can't make any decisions. I don't have lead in my pencil until Dr. Yang says I do. Diminishers don't trust others to figure it out for themselves, so they maintain ownership. When they delegate, they dole out piecemeal tasks, but not real responsibility. They give people just a piece of the puzzle. It's no wonder that people have a hard time putting the puzzle together without them. Eva Weissel is smart and energetic, and most unfortunately for her team, decidedly a morning person. As operations manager in a manufacturing plant, each day she'd come to work with a fresh set of ideas for her management team. She would plan out the day on her commute to work, arrive at the plant, walk through the door, and begin dropping by her people's office to let them know exactly what she wanted them to do that day. Some days it was more of the same, but other days the tasks took them in entirely new directions. Her people noticed the pattern and began a simple coping routine. Every day, about 8 a.m., they began lining up in the hallway that led from the lobby to their office area. With pads of paper and coffee in hand, they waited for her to burst in and deliver their marching orders for the day. It was just easier for everyone to wait to be told what to do. No doubt, Eva thought she was a great leader who was delegating and communicating clearly to her team. In reality, Eva was a micromanager who did all the thinking for her team and hoarded the ownership of the work. Jump in and out. Micromanagers hand over work to others, but they take it back the moment problems arise. They get lured in like a fish to the shiny objects on a fisherman's line. Emergent problems and big hurdles are irresistible bait for diminishers. They see these shiny objects and are attracted. They are fascinated by the intellectual challenge to solve the problem. They're lured by the attention and kudos they get for saving the day. And they're hooked on the feeling of importance as people become dependent on them and their brilliance to deliver results. They love to be lured in, and the diminishing impact on their people is set. The problem is that they don't just get lured in and stay there. They come in and out. An issue gets onto the radar screen of senior management, and suddenly they are all over it. They spring in, and when the fun is over, they spring back out. They are bungee bosses. Garth Yamamoto is the chief marketing officer for a consumer products company. Garth has two modes. One is all over it, and the other is completely absent. When his team is working on an issue with CEO visibility, he jumps in, takes over, and delivers the work straight to his boss, a highly mercurial leader. When the CEO isn't involved, Garth is nowhere to be seen. His people struggle to get his attention on the less visible but equally critical projects that form the backbone of the business. When these leaders bungee in and out of their organization, they create dependency and disengagement. When they strike at random, they produce disruptive chaos. Take it back. I was 25 years old and 6 months into my first management job. It was 7:30 p.m. as I sat at my desk at 500 Oracle Parkway, Oracle's main office tower. The halls were dark, and all my staff had gone home for the night. Everyone was home but me. I was still busy trying to close out my to-dos for the day, many of which had emerged during the course of the workday as one little crisis after another landed on my desk. I came up from my absorption in my work and thought, why am I still doing so much of the work? I've delegated. Why does it all come back to me? People were bringing me their problems, and I would take them back. At this realization, I became irritated at my team for dumping the problems on me and for not doing their jobs. Then, alone in a dark office, I had an epiphany. I wasn't doing my job. As a manager, my job was no longer about me. It was my responsibility to manage the work,